Welcome to The Way We Roll with Simon Minty and Phil Friend.
Hello and welcome to The Way We Roll with me, Simon Minty.
And me, Phil Friend.
Our guest this month is Peter Torres Fremlin. Peter and I crossed paths during COVID when he returned to the UK after 12 years living and working abroad. Peter and I share a few things, a love of travel, a keen interest in disability. Now, in my head, Peter, and I'm going to alienate you straight away, I've always thought we were both people of short stature, but I'm not convinced anymore. Sorry to be clunky. Where are you at on the disability scale?
No, I love that you saw me as a brother, Simon. I was born with a type of muscular dystrophy, relatively mild as they go. It's an Ulrich type, so my muscles were weak. And now it's a kind of a disability that upgrades itself. So I'm in the scale of that. But that's obviously we're sort of talking about it like from the impairment point of view, rather than the other aspects of disability that I'm sure we'll get into.
Absolutely. And sorry, it's just a kind of weird thing to ask straight away, but I hadn't realized.
No, but I'd only answer because we're siblings in the disability movement. Simon, if someone from outside the movement was asking, I would
it wouldn't be my opening question to a stranger as well. We're still brothers, and another brother, Phil.
Well, Peter's work is very impressive. He works on international cooperation, mainly on inclusion of persons with disabilities. He is a freelance consultant, and his work on disability focuses on employment and on mainstreaming disability.
Peter is a prolific writer. He's a journalist, and we share. He will share his links in our show notes. Perhaps the main writing is the Disability Debrief. It's a newsletter reporting on disability news from around the world and the people that are making change happen.
In a recent post, Peter says we need a new lens to report on disability. He says what we have had has been useful, powerful, but it doesn't tell the whole story and not speak to the messy complications of lived experience or how other issues or identities can intersect. Policy work, too, is based on generalizations and an often bullet-pointed distance from daily life. Can you explain this a bit more, Peter?
Thank you for bringing out that piece. I think it's one of the most important things that I've written this year that really sets out the stall of what I'm trying to do on Disability Debrief. But let me sort of rewind a little bit and say how I got there. I sort of started my disability work adventure with research on disability in Brazil. And there I met people with physical disabilities, and I was doing anthropological research with them, so spending a lot of time with them. And I saw, look, the disability title isn't the best way to get into their experience, or necessarily like my experience. It sums up some of it. It's extremely powerful. Knowing about the social model and seeing how our disabilities are socially constructed is extremely powerful. But it doesn't tell the whole story of like how my body is in the world, and how those effects play out, or even like how I relate with that disability label. So I had that chance to question it at the beginning of my career, but sort of a month after writing and defending a thesis saying, oh, I'm not going to use the word disability to talk about this issue, I then got a job working on disability, right? And you know how it is, you just get sort of sucked into that. And then my work on policy and programs around the world are speaking with, like, internationally, we're saying people with disabilities. Obviously, in the UK, we're probably going to say disabled people a bit more. But I was writing about this, and I was saying, are people with disabilities are more this, that, or the other, or more vulnerable to X, Y, and Z? And I'm like, well, I wouldn't like to be talked about like that, right? I wouldn't like to be summed up like that. How shall we say that? That contradiction, like at the heart of my work, that the way that I'm learning through work to talk about disabled people and my own experience weren't matching. And sort of, I found ways in my personal life to express this differently, but I couldn't quite say it in my professional life until through Disability Debrief, which started out as a resource for colleagues, but then with people's encouragement, it became somewhere I could share some of my own story, some of the contradictions, some of the life experiences of other people from around the world. I could see, like, we can't rest necessarily, like, on a fixed category when, like, life is much more messy than that. But disability isn't the only aspect of that, right? Sometimes disability is seen, some definitions have it just in terms of barriers, right? But our disabled experience and experience as disabled people isn't just that, like, our bodies and difference and the social engagement of them is a barrier. There's creativity and joy and pleasure and this community that we found as well. So that's why I wanted to, like, try in this new form of writing not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? To keep all that this disability view can give us. And it's given us so much. It's given us this movement. It's been really empowering for people. And this is the way organizations work on it now, whether it's an international organization or a business or whatever you might have. So how to keep that, how to sort of keep some of that truth and purpose of the activism as well, but make it a bit messy, right? Like, and relate it to our own lives, and then use that as a lens to kind of see the world in its messiness, right? To go out from our own experience and to take that further.
I like what you're saying, Peter. I think it's felt for the last 10, 15 years, we've been searching for a new way of understanding this. And partly this is generated by a new bunch of people, younger disabled people or people with disabilities, however we refer. And I can see they're trying to find their way. They don't have the social model to hang their hat on. It's almost like, how to explain it? What I get from you is almost like with certain ways we've done it so far, we've missed out the pain and we've missed out the joy. And there's these things that are either side and part of the human experience, rather than just straight down the middle, remove the barriers, all is done. I'm going to go a little bit deeper, because that same piece, which we enjoyed reading, quoting you, disability offers disruptions, whether it's the, in brackets, miss, as in the misbehaviors of our bodies and minds, the barriers we face, or the innovations we find. And you say we need to go beyond news reporting and journalism and include art into this, and poetry and other forms to inform us. I want a bit more.
For me, disability is much more. It's a lens through which I see things, right? Disability, I'll give you an example of a disability lens. Like, it tells me when a phenomenon is going on, like, people are going to face it differently, right? People are going to use a service or a shop or a train a little bit differently, right? People are going to sort of, if there's an alarm that's based on sound, like, some people aren't going to hear that. They're going to need an alarm that's based on light. So it's a way of sort of showing difference, and it's a way of emphasizing individual adaptations. And there's a lot of creativity in that as well. So that's, I think, kind of my call with that piece was, like, we make innovations, like, in how we connect with people, how we move about our houses. Like, we were just before the call talking about, like, all our assistive technologies and sort of how we accumulate those and how those play out in different places. Let's also sort of bring that to our writing and talking as well. And I really want to sort of speak to the diversity of it. Like, I go into my experience as a way of connecting with others and knowing that if I can see this richness and sort of bring to voice this richness in the many dimensions of my experience, that will match with the many dimensions of other people's experiences. So in that diversity, like, one of the things that I think we need to do, which is a bit difficult for an activist movement, is, like, we like to get out of the idea there's just one narrative, right? That there's just one way of talking about disability, there's just one correct way of talking about it, that I prefer, like, as a movement, we often prefer certain sets of words, and then we don't engage if there are a different set of words, or we might not engage if we can get very policing about it. Like, I certainly do this. I think you've had interesting discussions about it on your show, that you're watching something and then you're like, you get very like, but I don't like that message it's saying about disability. But like, ultimately, our end point has to have like a lot more diversity. And that's where that kind of creative side came in. Something that was a turning point for me when I realized that creative side was needed, when I was writing about the outbreak of the Ukraine war last year. And again, like, disability gives you a different view into that. It looks at who's left behind. It looks at who can't get to bomb shelters. It looks at who was already segregated and having challenges in society. It looks at how organizations were then responding to it in a humanitarian way. But I realized in that we were all feeling this tragedy, that it's not enough to just have the news and the facts and the statistics and these grim stories people were going through. And that's where I sort of plugged into some poetry. There was a really beautiful poet called Ilya Kaminsky. I think he's Ukrainian-American. He's deaf. And he wrote a collection of poetry, like, based around sort of deafness as a way into understanding military occupation and whatnot. Obviously, Ukraine had been at war for many years before. And so I needed, like, to understand this moment, we need that. We need some art. We need different ways in, because again, it's looking for that understanding, like, in a wide human way, not limited to some of the ways, like you brought out that phrase I said about bullet pointed, like distance of policy and its generalizations, which it's a very abstract, distant way of seeing it. And I want to sort of take that back into our lives. Because as we know, like, disability lives are messy. Like, how we get ready for the day, how we go down the street, like, how our day to day is. And I want to say, like, how does that messiness of day to day life impact our thinking? Right, like, that is what it's at the heart of it for me.
I suppose what you're reminding me and making me think about as you're talking is this idea we used to talk about, Simon and I and many others. This concept of a disability culture, the idea that there were all sorts of things going on within disabled people, whatever their disability impairment was, that brought them together. And you're saying, for example, poetry. You know, cultures have art and poetry and cinema and a whole range of other things. Simon's passion for comedy and so on. You'll find comedy different around some disabled comedians, for example. So is that what you're addressing here? I think what I'm getting off you is this idea that we talk about barriers and we talk about impairment and we talk about law and all that stuff as a movement, but we don't talk about enough, I'm sensing, the kind of culture that we see the world through, in a sense. So your disability, my impairment, I'm on wheels all the time. That gives me a different view of the world from someone who walks. But I tend to talk about the doors I can't get through rather than the poetry that makes me write. Is that the kind of line you're on with this?
I love that. I love that line that we've tended to talk about the doors that we can't get through rather than the poetics of a view from down here. It's making me think. I think that's something I'll definitely need to reflect on. I definitely want to celebrate that culture that's there. And one lead for me that pushed me in that direction was like the disability debrief just comes out of me gathering resources and curating resources, and then it grew into something else. I saw on social media, like, people working on disability would share all the official stuff, but then they also really shared, like, oh, this film came out and it's got XYZ in it, or doesn't have X, Y, and Z in it, or here's this song. And that's the popular stuff. And so I sense a real thirst that we have for that, for articulations of those different views from where we are. It is a cultural point. For me, it's also like an application of that view. I'll give you an example. So going back to my studies of anthropology, Like, I was reading about like anthropology of cities and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, look, none of this speaks to the fact that when I go out in a city, I might fall over, right? Like, how does those visions and like academic views of the world and the way we think about these things relate to my experience? I might fall over on the corner, or there might be a car blocking the path that I need to take, right? And so I want to kind of bring, that's the challenge that I have, like that view from, say, the wheelchair we're using, or that view from a body or mind that's like the brackets misbehaviors of it, and how, like, what different vision does that give us on the world? And it's not just, it's partly for us, obviously, but I want to sort of show people on the outside of the movement, whether they're disabled or not, that there's something like really exciting about this view, that it is a new way of looking at things, and you don't have to be like locked into disability to find that interesting. Like, that I find one of the ways we get sort of siloed is by like, oh, that's for the like the special thing for the special people, rather than sort of looking, ah, that's a kind of a community that's a real source of like innovation and grit and alternate approaches and diversity. Like, why isn't like like, that's exciting.
I do understand what you're saying, Peter, and I'm struck by two or three things. I apologize to Peter for my poor questioning technique, and I'm going to do it right now. I like exactly what you said, and then there's that bit, it's the grit, the innovation, but then that tips sometimes into, aren't they brave, aren't they inspirational? And so we always want to try and not get schmaltzy. I had a very difficult conversation with one of the leading disability rights activists in the UK. And I said, the problem I had with the movement in the early days was it didn't reflect all of me. It was so rigid, so dogma. And this person said to me, if we didn't, we wouldn't have got the change. We stuck to this very fine single purpose. And you said it's very difficult for a movement to have so much diversity because you start mixing the message. There's an American activist who died a couple of years ago, and I feel terrible. I can't remember her name. But she always said, though, before we can get to pride, we need community. You need community. So we're racing ahead going, oh, have pride in your disability or yada, yada, your identity. But without the community in the first place, it's quite hard to get to that point. I feel you're talking, it's what I call the maturity of something. It's a kind of, it's always been there. We've just not had the maturity to talk about it, or because it weakens certain things. It changes certain things. I'm going to be cheeky and move on.
No, like, I appreciate your style of asking questions. And you're like, sod it, I'm not even going to ask the question. but I want that question. Like, I'd sort of maybe answer to move on as well. No, I think like disability, we're using the same word in many different contexts, right? We're using it in an activist sense. We're using it in a bureaucratic sense. We're using it in a political sense. We're using it in a personal sense. The start of this conversation, we used it more in a kind of medical sense. And I think that it's definitely four different uses of that word. You need different levels of certainty and absolutism. And that's one of the things that I've tried to create on the debrief, and with support from readers, being able to create a space that we can do that reflecting and can do that questioning and can say, like, is this the right way to work on some of the subjects we're working on? And I really want a venue for that. And that doesn't, like, we've got to sort of be more absolutist in other circumstances to get the point across. And but there's a role in doing that. I want to be able to do reflection in public, which often happens if you know the right people and you do it behind the scenes. And I think your podcast does a really nice job about bringing some of those conversations out, but it's too often restricted to, like, if you know the people, you're in the conversation. And if you don't, you're just seeing the public side of things, which is sort of much more on the train tracks. But I think it sounds like you were going to get to some of the train tracks, Simon. So let's get to the train tracks.
And you're quite right. You needed to reply. The question I had, and it's more about your experience and how you navigate this. So you work for or have worked with some of the big international outfits around disability. I'm thinking of International Labour Organization. It's Humanity Inclusion, isn't it? Humanity and Inclusion, it used to be Handicap A International. I have this weird love-hate thing. I admire them, and yet I avoid them. My encounters have always been, I sort of feel I get lost in them. I feel it's bureaucracy. I feel there's pre-agreed deals, and by the time I turn up, the debate is redundant. Or it used to be there was a lack of disabled people in the room. There was a lot of people making the decisions. Or if you were disabled, you were sort of patronized. Now, I sense you need a mindset to work in that organization. You need to maybe be as bright and as academic as you. How were your experience? Have you, my sort of sweeping generalizations of it, I'm hoping that it's better than that. you need to still work with them.
I think I can be direct about it. They are like large bureaucracies, right? These are kind of, I've worked with international organizations, some of them like part of the UN, like the International Labour Organizations. I started my career at the United Nations Development Programme, did a bit of time with HI, and sort of then on a freelance basis with lots of these other things. These are sort of bureaucracies working in several countries, often like the UN then has like whole sort of governance things that are then very complicated and involve governments and other actors. So you're within those frameworks. It takes a long time to get within those frameworks, right? And you kind of, you have to kind of know, like, you have to kind of learn the rules of the game that you are playing. It's quite interesting that in the years that I've been working, in the past 10 years, there's been a real growth in the attention that these organizations are paying to disability. And actually, you'll be surprised to hear that the UK Tory government has been a big part of pushing that growth. So while we do one thing at home, we've like supported other people to look at it. So now there is more investment in like disability stuff, including specialists like myself. There's a lot more reports about it. And that's kind of where we get to the other side, right? Because it's a large bureaucracy, like it can be, it's by its nature very siloed. And so the disability report might be nice, but is the rest of the organization doing it? Unclear. And as for what it's like to work in, these bureaucracies are, it's like no secret, quite alienating to work in. Like I was very frustrated at the beginning of my career, and I thought it's because I'm a junior. Like they were like saying, it's because of your type of contract, it's because you're junior. But I'm also seeing people that are very senior in these organizations are also very frustrated, right? And also like there's with the strict hierarchies, and there's lots of sort of complicated decision-making processes, lots of dependent sort of funding patterns and whatnot that sort of leads to kind of sort of precarity in employment conditions and frustrations within that. Obviously, like add a disability to the mix and it starts getting a bit more interesting. And then maybe disability is also the subject you might cut if there is a funding gap. So that sort of, I mean, keeps it interesting. These organizations now are trying to like be more accommodating also to disabled staff. Like I would say that like I've had some quite good experiences. I've had some not so good experiences as well. I would say like the general ethos of the environment, of the employment environment, is like absolutely ableist, right? Because when you've got precarious working conditions and like you don't respect staff very much, like you're not gonna like suddenly be like disability accommodating. And I think that is the real interesting mix. And I'd be interested to see whether you guys see this in companies as well. Like we're now at a stage in lots of areas where it's just much more politically correct for an organization to say something like proper and what we'd want them to say about disability. Like, did they change their actions? Like, not necessarily. Is it any better to be an employee in that organization as disabled, like with a disability? Like, not necessarily at all. And like, I'm like, well, like, does that make it more insulting or less, right? Like, and I really want to kind of compare it to that. I think we need to, this is this awkward position as well, because we want to celebrate like those commitments people have made, and we don't want to rain on the parade, but it can lead to real division with lived experience, right? Which was another reason, like touching on the beginning of our conversation. I'd be interested how you guys see that, because you've seen this like lived through a real transition in like the public declarations about disability by big organizations, and like whether that's how you relate that to the like the actual experiences of disabled people within these organizations.
I'd say that I would say, and I genuinely mean this, I think things are very different now for large employers and not so large employers. They've kind of got the message, and like you were saying, Peter, from your own experiences, there are times where you come across stuff, you're never still doing that, are you? And then you come across something else where you think, bloody hell, that's so innovative and clever, and why haven't we thought of that? I wanted to pick up your question and move it a bit and see. I think one of the great things about you is that you have clearly got a severe condition which you have to manage. You spent, I think, 4 years in Bangladesh, not famously full of innovation from my stereotypical view of Bangladesh. You've lived your life having to manage all sorts of situations where the infrastructure and various other things may have been lacking. And I kind of marry that to what you were just saying about what goes on in some of the big organizations that are supposed to help. Even they discriminate in some ways against disabled employees. But can you help me understand how, I think our listeners would really be interested to know how you managed living with a very severe impairment in environments which clearly were, and that kind of reflects on what you've been saying earlier about the poetry of that, the kind of fun of that, the sheer excitement of that.
Thank you.
I was going to say, you're going to answer in a song for us, Peter, about your time in Bangladesh. That would be lovely.
The Bangladeshis would love that. It really is a culture. Like, we were doing a training program once. It was quite boring, and then we had lunch, and then like, oh, let's sing a song. And say, like, I can't sing, but it would go, I mean, Bangla gan guy, just like, oh, I sing in Bangla, and then there's a celebration. It's a celebration of the culture, which is the aspect that really brought me to Bangladesh. I learned to speak Bengali. I really fell in love with the place. I think sort of taking a step back on like severe, I think sort of, I wouldn't use that term myself. And when I first went to Bangladesh, I think if we're going to use terms like that, I would be in the moderate camp. So like I was walking like slowly and had difficulty with stairs, and like I really like just to be very concrete, I'd been there once to like teach a bit of English, and like somehow it all been set up for me, so I managed. And then I went back and I was like, I'm going to study Bengali for 6 months. Like week two, I realized everywhere has steps, and I'm like, what on earth have I done? Like, I can't do anything here, right? Week three, I realized that anywhere I go, someone is going to help me up the steps. And it is a beautiful confidence to have in a place. It's partly because I'm a white foreigner, but it's not just because I'm a white foreigner. It's also partly because I'm a man, but it's not just those things. Like some disabled Bangladeshis get that assistance, some don't, which is then quite the interesting dynamic we need to look at. I ended up calling this like the soft accessibility rather than the hard accessibility. And I think, Phil, just to sort of also represent like Bangladesh pride, Bangladesh is like absolutely a source of innovation. Like if I was looking for innovation, I wouldn't look to Silicon Valley, which has a huge infrastructure for it and a huge infrastructure for, like, you have an idea and you get connected with an X, Y, and Z and like millions of dollars to do it, I would look to poor communities around the world, because people are hustling and sort of making do with what they have and finding new ways to do it. In the same way that I'd also look to disabled people for innovation. So Bangladesh is like one of the development success stories in its journey, like out of being the, like, literally, it was sort of the term breadbasket was perhaps coined for a description of Bangladesh in the 70s when it became independent. And it's a real sort of it's a real case study of development, and the disability movement there has lots of vibrancy for it. And that was actually what connected me to disability issues. So there was a lot of inaccessibility, there was a lot of getting lifted about the places, and there was a bit of like walking on roads I wasn't comfortable to walk on, and there was a little bit of falling off cycle rickshaws, but like not onto the floor, right? Like just onto the lower part of the cycle rickshaw, and that's like relatively okay, right? And then the other, like, I mean, sort of, it's interesting. After Bangladesh, I then lived in Egypt for 4 or 5 years. And there was the kind of same question. A colleague said to me, like, well, what are you going to do? It's really inaccessible. Again, in Egypt, I was sort of mostly walking and then using a car and whatnot. It's like, well, like when I go to a new country, like I need to know whether that assistance will be there. So like in my first week in Egypt, I didn't yet speak any Arabic. I was turning up at the Arabic class. So day three, I turned up in the Arabic class, my first week. The someone from the building shouted across the street to the taxi driver that I needed help up the step. And I'm like, well, with a culture like that, I'm going to manage. Right? So there's that other angle. But Phil, I really appreciate you asking, because it is quite, it's an interesting factor about my international experience. It's one that I thought about a lot, but like it's most colleagues don't ask, and they kind of like, when they see you doing it, they just sort of assume that it's like, oh, he does that now. And so I really appreciate that chance to get to talk about it.
What struck me about your response, which perhaps we should listen to over here a bit, is my line is, if I can't get into a restaurant because you haven't built a ramp, you're not carrying me. I'm not going in. I'm going to go somewhere else. Whereas in Bangladesh, we don't bother to adapt the buildings. We just carry you in. It's a completely different solution to the same problem. And I kind of like that, because I think there is something genuinely pleasant about being offered and assisted to do things, because there's a relationship between you and the helper, which otherwise you would never have. You're suggesting to me that I now need to lead a movement which demands that everybody carries us in and is nice to us, kind of.
Phil, I would maybe like sort of separate out a bit, because the guy carrying you is not the guy that built the building. So and often the people like hanging around helping out are the people that might be less privileged economically. But you're totally right about that relationality of the culture. I do get sort of good assistance in the UK, but for instance, like so when I fell over in public, in some countries like Brazil, people will run to assist you. In the UK, like people look at you like nervously and a bit scared, and then like you kind of have to do the work. This is massive generalization, but you have to do the work of like just a bit of charisma and say, and then they look really relieved you've asked them for help, right? Because like because they're like, shit, like, but I don't want to be awkward, or maybe they'll be upset, like if it, like we get into this kind of whole British culture about it. Whereas in other places, I mean, in Egypt, many disabled people report like the problem is people just start helping you without asking. Yes. Right. So obviously like huge generalizations here, but there are those differences. Other cultures have that instinct relationality and interdependence, getting up in each other's business in a way that isn't so present in public spaces in the UK, and it does make it it's a different disability experience. Obviously, we do want the both, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I was struck by that conversation, and I also took from what you said when you're working with ILO or HI, and you learn the rules. I know this when I go to different countries. You learn the rules, how it operates. I choose what my battles are. I remember being in Hong Kong many years ago, trying to go up the stairs, leaving the ferry, and I was bringing my backpack. I was backpacking then. I had it on wheels, and I was three steps up, and suddenly the backpack just sort of floated. And I looked around and there was someone carrying it for me. Now, independent me is like, ooh, sensible me is like, thank goodness for that. So, yeah, there are bigger structure things. I think if it's done with a warmth, that must have been, I mean, that's amazing. Because I think if I turn up to a country and every other person who had a disability was being helped, would I be, this is brilliant? Or would I be going, oh, no, this, I've... but you've got to have a mindset. It sounds like you knew how to navigate it and you knew when it was appropriate and it was... Again, I'm not asking a very good question, but I'm struck by it. And I think it's
maybe I did, Simon. I think it's really important that we look at the soft. I call this like the soft accessibility, not just the hard accessibility.
Yeah, I like the phrase.
Because even if you look, there are plenty of places saying, I feel your restaurant has a ramp, but you needed like some other like just adaptation just to make it work for you. And then they're like, no, we're not doing that. Right. And in that case where you've got the soft accessibility, they are going to make the adaptations. I think sort of the stereotype about Switzerland is very much like this. Like, we're going to follow the rules. If you need something outside of the rules, no. So it's like, it's a great country. If you want someone to hold a door open for you and you're using a wheelchair, it's maybe not a great country. Like if you need like some sort of individual adaptation, again, like, huge generalizations, but to get across these different dynamics. Obviously, my discussions with the disability community in Bangladesh, I was saying, like, it's wonderful we have this soft accessibility. And they were like coming back with things like you're saying, look, we can't rely on that. We can't just rely on the kindness of strangers and whatnot. But they're also doing it in their personal lives. The most striking story that I can't get out of my head is like a blind friend I had there, and he was like catching buses. Buses in Bangladesh do not stop at bus stations. They maybe do not even stop. So his strategy was to like go to someone that was waiting, and he was like, you run, I'll hold on to you. Yeah. So it's like completely wild. And yes, he did.
No health and safety there.
He did like face plant a few times, and he did, because like maybe you're on the pavement and you have to run onto the road, and that there was a bit of face planting every now and again. But like, it speaks to a dynamic of an obvious totally wrong situation. But it speaks that dynamic of interdependency, and like, what does inclusion look like, right? Like when we don't have that physical accessibility, right? That's there, like, and how there are those different approaches to inclusion and creating that. And we don't need to wait until like we have made everything perfect, following every code and done the huge investments and done all of the elevators. And we cannot wait for that as well.
Just one sentence to say thank you for rebalancing that as well, because I think we can be romantic and kind of go, oh, it's wonderful how people, and then you're like, hold up, if I live there and this is all the time and all the other things,
exactly,
it becomes less romantic.
I was just struck by how that blind man's experience of traveling on buses, and what kind of, going back to what you said very early on in this conversation, Peter, about the kind of cultural, the poetic, the lenses we look through, it would be fascinating to listen to that man's experiences of life, given that some of it was spent doing some quite dangerous and hazardous things in order to travel around. I mean, he did not travel. He just found a way.
He loved it. I was like, he was like, look, I walk quickly and sometimes I fall into potholes. And I'm like, well, what about walking slower? I'm not the first person in his life to suggest that to him. But he was at a stage in life, he didn't have time. He didn't have time for health and safety. And like, I mean, that's also like at different stages in our life. We now maybe,
but his stories, if captured, if we'd had the time and a tape recorder or something, we sit down and just talk. There is a life this man is leading.
No, you're totally You're totally right, Phil, and that ambition really motivates me to share those different stories, because I met so many sort of people whose both their work and like their kind of baller approach to life for want of a better word, inspiring. Sorry, gentlemen.
Yes,
I don't know
yes.
if we're allowed to say that on this show, but is really fascinating and a different window. And this is what I mean for like, yeah, the world is going to look a bit different from those different perspectives. And that thanks has kind of like inspired me to carry on trying to bring out those different voices.
Maybe he's a future guest. I want to get back into some bigger stuff. The World Health Organization, this is part of the disability debrief. You mentioned it to us as well. Their report on the inequalities of health for disabled people. The bit that I struck is, you know, the breadth of this, which we sometimes forget, and how fortunate it can be. It was about the response to the crisis exposed by the COVID pandemic. It also mentioned about reimagining health systems. And I think the phrase I read was the missing billion. I love this and I really like the title, but there's a little bit inside me. I'm scared of these reports that are powerful, but what actually happens? Who reads them? What will be the impact? Again, very poor question. And maybe could you put a little bit of flesh on the bones about this report? And do you have hopes that it will push the agenda forward, improve things?
Yeah, no, that's a question I really struggle with as well. Basically, there were sort of two quite important reports that came out on in terms internationally and gathering evidence on the health situation of disabled people around the world. There was one from the WHO, and then there's one, Missing Billion is an organization that is trying to shift these systems as well. Tom Shakespeare, who you've had on, is involved in that, I think. They're making a really good contribution to gather like the available evidence on these subjects that I write. What you're kind of referring to is the piece that I wrote that tried to bring out elements of those, and I think sort of I've forgotten the exact headlines, but it's sort of gaps in life expectancy between people with and without disabilities were sort of 10 to 20 years. And it really did a sort of devastating job about showing like all the issues that go into that. And that was the new thing for me. Like I've been sort of in my return to England, I was like, well, let's spend some time in the NHS, because I mean, pride of the country. So I've been doing that as a side project. But it showed, these reports showed that there's so much out of the hospitals that informs our health, like our education, our employment, our living conditions all contribute to our health. And in it can get into quite vicious cycles where exclusion in one area then leads to exclusion in another, and they both impact on poorer health that then compounds the exclusion. So that bit was quite depressing to read. Will they make change? That is kind of the question at the heart of what I was saying earlier, that do these like declarations by big organizations like lead to tangible difference? I think that we've kind of got to understand these reports in their context, that a lot of the WHO report is like trying to get their colleagues to look at things differently and try and say to colleagues, look, there is the evidence. You should think about disability when you're doing like XYZ health intervention. The WHO is governed by health ministries from around the world. So it's also a message to them. The vicious circle aspect also means that the way out is if we improve our lives in one area, if we have more access to education and employment, we're going to improve our health as well. It's going to go together. So there is that hope for the way out. As for can health systems, is the healthcare going to be more friendly towards disabled people? I don't know, because it's obviously better resourced health systems would be better for everyone. And some, like, there's really kind of grotesque discrimination that disabled people just, like, excluded from, like, even going to hospital because of their situation, or that they can't reach it, or that they can't afford it, or a doctor looks at them and is like, yeah, not you, mate. But there's also, like, the much more complicated discrimination that I'm sure you guys are very, very aware of, like our patients listen to. Can the doctor see, like, our health conditions and our disabilities in their totality, or are they just going to sort of treat us as a standard patient? And my sort of little sort of extended tourism I've been doing of the NHS, obviously good and bad examples within that, but sort of a bit of skepticism about how modern sort of production line medicine is mm-hmm. going to be able to be adaptive to that. And it's like, there's a deeper problem in, like, how medical organizations are structured, how people are trained to their speciality, the hierarchy of specialities and different disciplines within hospitals, and the impact on, even in very high resource settings, they don't listen to the patient, right? Like, so that seems to me a much, and some of those issues go beyond what these reports are suggesting, which are more like a reformist way. We've got a system, let's make it a bit better. Let's do an awareness training. Let's put a ramp in. Let's sort of make it sort of a bit more accessible in these ways. But, like, health systems, if they are even systems, as that piece asks, are, like, really have like much more broken and exclusionary aspects to them that reform won't fix. Like, and I sort of get back to that question of why, even in a high resource setting, do medical professionals find it difficult to listen to patients?
Right. I think we're getting near the end of our time, which is always scary because there's like 20 other things that we want to talk about. But I suppose I've always wanted to get a feel for how someone like you, Peter, who's traveled extensively, lived amongst different groups of people, particularly disabled people, obviously, and lived a life abroad in all the ways you have, how you see disability worldwide, in the sense of, because when you were talking about health there, I've always felt that the reason that my doctor doesn't perhaps listen to me much is because he doesn't see my life as having much value, because obviously I'm in a broken body and all that stuff. I'm wondering how you see that, flying your helicopter across the planet Earth and having worked in so many bits of it. What's your take on disability as an international thing? Are we just as useless at the valuing people here as we are, say, in, I don't know, Peru? Or do you know what I mean? Does that make sense, that kind of question?
It does, and thank you for broadening that like our view out. You do see a lot of similar problems in different places about sure. that kind of that sort of grotesque discrimination and the harms that can come about. Sort of, I love being part of this sort of international disability work movement sector, whatever we call it, because I know that, like, in every country in the world, there is someone that I can connect with because they are plugged into, like, work related to the UN Convention, or they're plugged into, like, this way we have of talking about things, like, coming from the social model view, and then obviously our different positions in relation to that. So I love it for that scope of connection. I think that is a sort of, like, a tiny minority of disabled people in that country that are plugged into that movement and that identity, like this country, although in this country it's much more extensive, I would say, than many. But it's a real, that gives it a sort of real a real joy to be connected to brothers and sisters around the world, seeing things in similar terms. As for the experiences of disabled people, I think they're sort of incredibly incredibly diverse. And it was kind of like it was this conversation also helped me reflect on, like, are there different forms of inclusion? Those different forms are going to be sort of more or less preferred in different cultural contexts, different ways that sort of people dream about living their lives, and different sort of barriers that are faced to that and solutions that they find. So, like, I think that, like, part of the aspect of what I'm trying to do on the debrief is to, like, try and sort of take a really global view, but also not to try and, like, not to seek too many similarities, because then you get a little bit into, like, generalizing too much and you don't see other differences in people's lives and these kind of complications that we explored today.
I'm finding you very quotable, Peter. I'm a magpie sometimes, and I pick up little lines. You go, oh, that encapsulates something very well. So I appreciate that, and I think that grotesque discrimination is one of them. It's not a great thing to talk about, but it's a really powerful. It just takes it to that level. And you're going back to the health inequalities, the modern production line of medicine. It's an amusing story more than anything. When I had to get my blood tested and I was in a large UK hospital, they've got 30 or 40 different booths behind these shower curtains that you just go in. And it's like Argos shopping. You wait for your number to pop up and you go straight in. And I sat down and I said to them, just to warn you, because of my condition, it's quite difficult to get blood and to get a vein. And he went, all done. And I went, what? I didn't even finish the sentence to explain what my difficulty was. And I thought, oh my life. Now, half of me was impressed. And the other half of me, they haven't got time. They've got to get on to the next person. And it's kind of, I'm frustrated that we're getting towards the end. I have a sort of twee question, but it's sometimes when I'm on board, it's one of the last questions. And we say, we're going to give you a magic wand. And you can, by waving this wand, have, I don't know, one single huge shift or something that you really want to change. Impossible to answer that, but if you did on the spot have to come up with something, what would your magic wand, what would the
no thanks Simon I think it's something that sort of at the heart of this conversation, also what makes this conversation possible, it would be like the connection of disabled people with other disabled people. I'm not so fussed about what term they connect in that, but I've seen, like, through these travels, the power and how it transforms lives to meet people facing comparable challenges to your own, to get out of the isolation of thinking these challenges are just yours to deal with, right? There's an extraordinary power to that. It gives the culture and the poetry and the song to it. It's what's brought us here together as well today. And as I've seen, sort of whether it's a club playing wheelchair rugby, whether it's a group of disabled people in a town in Bangladesh that are meeting. And I was very lucky to be sort of meet with them in a town called Rajshahi. And that changed my life and changed the possibilities for it. So it's those connections. And this, just to sort of take us out of the magical wand and into my sort of bureaucratic comments, I said there's been more attention from bureaucracies to disability internationally than there has been. Like, I don't feel they've been investing in this mobilization. I think they've been sort of investing in kind of research and programs and, like, meetings and big reports. I don't see them investing in, like, look, we want organizations to sort of go out and have something in this town and do meetings with other disabled people and see what comes out of that. But this is where, like, tell me this isn't where we came from, right? Tell me this isn't why we're here today. Like, I really want that. It's the intervention that I most believe in. Like, all the other interventions can, like, be linked with that and whatever, like, but a training or a grant or a support or whatever doesn't change your life in the same way that meeting other people that connect with and give you a shared sort of validation and give you a shared shared love and purpose in life.
One of my most nourishing moments is when I do my international work and I'm visiting places rather than living, And then I run into a bundle of local disabled people, whether they're activists, whether they've just been invited, doesn't really matter. And the two things happen. We find our commonality, the barriers, the identity, whatever it might be. And then at some point I'll do a joke and they laugh because they, and I'm like, they get it. It's the same. We are. And it doesn't matter what country. There'll be a moment where there's a little bit of humor that, and it just warms me. There's something really special about that.
I think we have got to end now, but I just wanted to end by saying, Peter, that what you've done for me, and I hope for those that listen to us, is to remind us that there is a huge world out there and we're a very small bit of it. And you triggered a memory that has lived with me for a long time. I went to Vancouver way back for a major international disability conference. And I was with a bunch of Canadian men, all men, chatting away. And this woman, an Indian woman, joined us in a wooden wheelchair. I've never forgotten this. And we were all talking about our powered chairs and all this kind of stuff. And we looked at her and said, what do you think about this conversation? And she said, well, there is a bit of a problem, which is where would we charge it?
Mm.
And she told us about her village. She traveled overland to get to Canada, taking her about 3 weeks because she couldn't fly. So she'd come by ship. Her village had clubbed together to pay the money for her to come. What you're reminding me of is that there is all sorts of stuff out there that we need to remember. And her story was a very poetic story. It wasn't one of, she talked really movingly about her life in her village. And it reminded us and me particularly, but the Canadian guys I was with, that we really should not take things for granted. We need to reach out and look at what's going on in other countries to see if we can help there. So that's my, what you've done for me in this conversation is to bring home to me that whilst I am locked in my little world and trying to make it sense of it all out there, there is all sorts of challenges that people face. So I'm grateful. Thank you, Peter, for joining us and for sharing your thoughts, because it's epic stuff. And you've led a very interesting life.
No, thank you. Thank you both. It was such a pleasure. We could obviously sort of talk about power chairs a lot. There are some situations like now you've got the charging, but like, you don't have the roads or the transport, so you might prefer like a more lightweight one, as you know. But sorry to get into details. That is, again, the disability lens, pivoting between those details and those bigger things. It was such a pleasure to share with you guys. I knew that we would be able to sort of hang out and have fun. I really appreciate it.
I suspect in the next couple of years there'll be a very big story or a very big report or something, and maybe we'll have another conversation and we can delve a little bit deeper, because I like the depth, but I also like, you know, having those chats. So thank you very much for your time, Peter. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you, Peter.
I knew Peter would be an interesting person to speak to. I'm really appreciative of his time.
Yeah. I mean, I just love the angle that Peter brought, which is this sort of international, looking at other countries, some of the issues they face, and also marrying that up with the kind of cultural stuff of poetry and things, as he calls it, different lenses. Interesting take. Yeah, good stuff.
And I like his bit about that. I said it in the show, when you do meet with other peoples and you find the commonality, there's differences, but the commonality doesn't matter where you are in the world. And that's really something quite special.
And I am going to go around now and just ask people to help. I'm just going to wait for people to help me. I'm not going to bother anymore. I've been getting it wrong all these years. Interesting angle, wasn't it? That it's natural for many countries, cultures and so on, just to help. It's the way it's done.
And the flip side, when you fall over here, no one helps you because we're all embarrassed with fear. I mean, that's ridiculous when you look at it that way. We know we're generalizing, but yeah, something in there.
Okay, so
that's it. If they want to go and have a little read of Peter's disability debrief, there's a load of great stuff in there. We will put the links in the show notes. If they want to drop us a line,
that's at mintyandfriend@gmail.com.
And obviously social media. We're Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, or Beacon. Do Beacon, and then the way we roll, you'll find a whole load of stuff, and you can subscribe to our mailing list so you'll never miss a show.
Yeah, and although we haven't done letters and stuff today, emails today, do keep telling us what you think about the show and keep us informed. We'll try and mention a few next time we meet.
Your pigeon's just arrived. You sent me with that message. Thanks for that.
Wasn't it an owl?
That's Harry Potter, isn't
Harry
it?
Harry Potter owl.
Yeah. I'd love an owl.
I'd love an owl. All right. Take it easy, Simon.
Thank you. Nice to see you. And thanks for listening, everybody.
This is The Way We Roll, presented by Simon Minty and Phil Friend. You can email us at mintyandfriend@gmail.com or just search for Minty and Friend on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn.